Long-term perspective.
Yeah, long-term perspective.
It isn't us. I'll repeat the cold part. Not having done any TSK, I think what helps me is that I'm doing the Kumye, and not that they're in any way related, although we have done many of the exercises that we have here, we have actually done Kumye. So that makes it actually less of a disconnect, but I think had that not been the case, I might have felt closer to what Deborah was feeling. Because sometimes when we start, actually the very first time when we started doing the exercise, and we just sort of sat there, it was kind of a surprise. I was like, oh, that's doing the exercise. You know, and I didn't say anything or ask anything about it, but I could see how weird that might seem, because it seemed weird to me. And I was like, just as a little bit of feedback, because there was no introduction to say, and the way in which we do the exercises, we just sit in silence for 20 minutes or whatever, and we do, you know, blah, blah, blah. You just sort of said, and we'll have 20 minutes. That was kind of it.
That's interesting. That's good.
Exactly. Well, I mean, at least that's how it seemed. I mean, either that or there was, you know, we all conspired to not say anything. Right? But, you know, and I was part of that conspiracy. But it was definitely, I definitely had the sense that people knew what to do. I should forage in my brain.
Originally, this was targeted towards the online course participants or people who have had exposure.
Yeah.
Then we decided, oh, we'll open it up. It's for anybody. There's no special training needed. So we thought we'd try it. Tried it. Didn't work quite the way we'd hoped. So we'll, you know, reassess and go back. But I can, you know, having come in from a different way, I can appreciate, you know, how what she felt, and I feel somewhat responsible in encouraging her to come and then having her have this experience that wasn't as fruitful as she had hoped.
I think it's okay just to speak for a minute about Deborah. She explained that she followed her intuition on things like this. She had received an email, even though she wasn't on our list as far as she knew, so somehow this strange thing had happened, and it came at a moment for her that was right, so she decided to do it, and you know, that will work itself out. I actually don't feel bad about her, and especially because I get a sense she's got a very strong sense of who she is and what she's doing.
And she wants to stay there.
Yeah, that's also true. But, you know, it would be easy enough. Well, first of all, it actually turns out at this point that everybody does have some familiarity with TSK.
Right.
You know, yours, Dick, maybe more as an eavesdropper, although you came to one program, didn't you? Some weekend or something?
Yeah, class at Tom and Ken.
Well, you also took his class.
He took, well, that was in TSK,
September.
But
last September.
Okay, it wasn't TSK. Right, it wasn't TSK.
It leaked in.
It leaked in. I have trouble maintaining my boundaries. and Pamela, you tried to take the online class.
I did.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I have actually read all of Love of Knowledge, and I started Time, Space, and Knowledge. So I wasn't as completely new to the teaching, but like the practice of it just felt weird.
Right. No, I think that's a very good point. And I'm not sure I even do enough of that, even if I'm with brand new people. I think I may more, you know, save people. So, you know, something like, yeah, now we're just going to sit here. That is kind of an exterior view of it. I mean, kind of, you know.
Maybe you could call it an intersize.
Intersize, right? Maybe we do need a new word. I don't vote for intersize.
No, I'm just saying that exercise, you know, people tend to think exo.
Oh,
intersize.
Right. An inquiry, an active inquiry. Isn't that a therapy term or something?
Anyway. Some of this work really taps into some deep seeds in the unconscious. Especially Dr. Walker and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So some uncomfortable stuff can come that I had a meaningful but yet uncomfortable dream. And I know the night before my roommate had a very difficult dream.
That was Deborah.
Yes, Deborah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to decipher and put things in perspective and not react or make a move or say something that you know where it belongs and you don't mix them all up. And that's very hard. I know from my own past that if things like that would happen, I would find unconsciously something that wasn't going right and I would hold on to that and say, that's the reason.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, I just don't belong. But instead of more being courageous, easing into my discomfort, shakily finding my comfort zone in that discomfort, I would do different maneuvers, and I have done it many, many times. But as if maybe I got tired of just kind of running away. To some of these teachings and workings, try to blindly find what is true, and rest at that even very uncomfortable, shaky ground. So I say that so don't put too much value or build on what is few words comes out and said that not necessarily is not true or doesn't even hit the core of what has happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, that's helpful. I think there's two, I don't want to spend too much time talking about this because we're, I appreciate that people are interested and want to reflect on this. I think that's great and it's very helpful. But it seems to me there's two things that come up repeatedly with TSK. One is, well, three things maybe. If I kept going. I better stop. One is people say it's too heady and conceptual. You know, I think there are people who teach it differently than I do, where maybe that's less true. My wife and I actually co-led a TSK workshop in Europe. First time we ever taught together, actually. She's a great fan of TSK. She never gets to teach it, but she loves TSK. And actually had a lot to do with the illustrations in Love of Knowledge. That was basically her responsibility. Mine was the text, hers was the illustrations. And she worked on Sacred Dimensions, too. Anyway, she does it much more in terms of a kind of a sensory appreciation of space and time, which I think is great. But, you know, I do it the way that it kind of speaks to me, comes to me. And sometimes I've been inspired by her to try some other things, but I haven't so far here. So I think I encourage that, perhaps. But so that's one thing. People say it's just too intellectual. So these things are all kind of related. The second thing is they say, I don't understand the books. And you know, one way of saying that is, well, they're too intellectual or make, you know, ask me to, you know, I just can't understand them. And I think there's, you know, they are pretty difficult reading. Mostly. As I said yesterday, one of the projects I would dearly love to do is write something that perhaps was a bit more accessible. I feel somewhat confident at this point that I could do that without, you know, just throwing out the baby with the bathwater. But that's one reason why when I do a program, especially a retreat, I usually like to work with the text at least a little, because I want people to recognize. And, you know, those of you in the online program know that we, in that case, we work a lot with the text. I want people to recognize that if you go into the text, that in itself is an exercise, and you can work with them. They really, you know, come alive. They respond well to, you know, watering and nourishment. I mean, if you bring that kind of intention and caring, then they blossom and they yield very rich fruits. Metaphor kind of works. The third thing that's also related is that people say, you know, when I come on a retreat, I want to be able to have experiences that are nourishing and rich and kind of deepen my appreciation for being alive. I think TSK offers all of that, but sometimes, you know, you also go through these kind of rough patches where you do an exercise, and a particular exercise, and you have no idea what to do, and you say, well, that's not what I'm here for. So that's another aspect of saying, well, it's kind of, maybe it's too intellectual, or it's not, it doesn't speak to the reason that I'm here. And then I'll add a fourth and stop before I get too, before I just keep going. And that is, sometimes people say, well, you know, I'm already studying Buddhism, or whatever it is. It doesn't have to be Buddhism, but typically the people we get are interested in Buddhism. And they say, so you know, why should I turn away from that to this other teaching? And of course the answer to that is it's not turning away, it's bringing in another dimension to whatever you care about. And it may be Buddhism, or it may be science, or it may be some other religious traditions. I say we haven't gotten too many people from other religious traditions, but it's come up, and I think that's fine. You know, these teachings would be wonderful for people to study who are in some other spiritual tradition. I don't think there's a conflict. There's a kind of a natural affinity with Buddhism, because Buddhism has the same kind of cutting away quality, you know, cutting through quality that TSK does, of saying, well, there are no final positions. Whereas I think in some other spiritual traditions, there's a sense of that you want to arrive at a final position. So that might be an issue, but that's different.
Sure.
You could be number five.
One thought that I have is that one thing in my experience that I, you know, struggle with, I find it an interesting struggle with, is the whole idea that TSK challenges the sense of self, which can be, you know, pretty unsettling to really take in. And especially, I mean, I'm a therapist, and Deborah was a therapist too, that the Western therapy deals with this stuff. My understanding is that the process that she studied has to do with thinking of people as being lots of different cells and dialoguing between them and integrating that, which the idea, again, for me, without knowing anything about that process, is something that I do. Therapy is strengthening the self, or, you know, develop the self, and then suddenly, you know, TSK or Buddhism is eliminating the self. I find that fascinating to explore.
Right.
I mean, I have no idea if this was or not, but I can imagine somebody saying, well, you know, when you get rid of self, that's who you are. That's, you know.
No, it's a good point, and I guess you could kind of lump together a number of things like that as a kind of a terminology issue. It may be deeper than terminology, but at least on the surface, it's a terminology issue. And I mentioned another example of that the other day. There are people in the Krishnamurti and David Bohm tradition reject knowledge, I think, basically because they think of it in the technological sense, and say, oh, knowledge, that's what we've got to get rid of, you know, the commitment to knowledge, whereas Rinpoche uses it, of course, is a very positive term. You would run into those issues.
I have number six.
Okay.
TSK is very threatening.
to belief systems, to any belief systems, mm-hmm. because TSK has you inquire against in everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that can be very psychologically scary if you come into the situation and you're already having problems
mm-hmm.
with depression or whatever like that. Now, it can be very helpful,
mm-hmm.
but it can
mm-hmm.
be very scary at first.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it can be like, oh, I'm running for the hills.
Mm-hmm.
These people don't know what they're doing. They're asking me to question. I think that it takes a special type of person
mm-hmm.
to really, you know, what you were saying last night. I understood that because it does take us. It takes a special type of person to be. It takes a truth seeker.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody that really, really wants to break down limits, break down conditions, and break down barriers. And you've got to be at that level before I think you can take on TSK.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are two somewhat separate points, 7A and B or something. 6A and B, I can't remember. But the first one I think is really true, and something to watch out for is, you know, I haven't really ever had that issue come up that I can remember of somebody, you know, where I was really concerned that this was doing them harm because they had a shaky sense of self or something, and this was just going to reinforce certain tendencies they had. I can't remember that that's ever come up. I think in part it's kind of a self-protective thing. If people have those kinds of concerns, then they're not going to stick with this or get involved in the first place, or if they do kind of by mistake, then they'll protect themselves. Right.
Also, to attribute, going back to the question of personal issues in here, I mean, it's not information, but it's still in the category of a learning process, which happens at NEMA too, rather than a self-exploration. You can apply it, or you cannot apply it, or you can use it or not. So the format protects against people falling apart
mm-hmm.
in here. I mean, not necessarily this room, but I think that it's still couched in a study, in the inquiry
mm-hmm.
part. So, as with Krishnamurti, you know, you could read it, or you could hear him, or you could do anything, and you say, well, it applies, that's very interesting, but now I'm going to the movies, you know. You don't necessarily have to take it so far in, and
mm-hmm.
it's built in.
Mm-hmm.
It's a built-in protective mechanism, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean it that in the bad sense of the word.
No, I think I understand, and I think that's true. Okay, let me add one more that has come up already in our discussion. It's good to air these things and kind of have them in one place, you could say. I mean, when I say one place, I'm actually looking at this little this red eye in front of me. It's already come up, and that is to say, but in TSK, there's, you know, where's the love? Where's the compassion? Where's
mm-hmm.
the, you know, where's that dimension of human being? And we talked about that, but it's not something that you cultivate in a very, open or kind of obvious way. Is everything? Now we're going to do an exercise with compassion. A little bit. There's some openings for that. But mostly, no. And I guess related to that is something that Rinpoche brings up. You know, most of you maybe know about this, but it's interesting to look at. The beginning of dynamics of time and space, there's a section that's 3 or 4 pages long where Rinpoche says, people are not very clear about what TSK is. I keep getting asked that question. I don't remember how he introduces it, something like that. He says, well, let me tell you what it's not. And he spends 3 or 4 pages listing things, and that's related to some of the things we're talking about. But one thing he says specifically is he says, TSK does not have an ethical system, unlike Buddhism. He says, it doesn't tell you do this or do that. Now again, if you take to heart the possibilities for a different kind of knowing, growing out of a different relationship to time and space, that seems to have ethical consequences. you know, it changes. And it's kind of obvious in a way why it would, because if you don't privilege the self in the usual way, then you relate to the world and to other people in a very different way. It just seems very natural. But it definitely doesn't have, you know, chapter 23,
right,
the moral code, you know.
No, I think that's for me one of the attractions of Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's more comprehensive in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a devotional piece.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Active, mm-hmm, in this. And as we're talking, I'm thinking, here's another heretical thought, that maybe the title, the name of it, isn't the best name in terms of
time, space, and knowledge.
Comprehensive.
Oh, I love that title.
It doesn't have an embrace, you know, that actually, as you've been describing and as we've been talking, it is, mm-hmm, in there, but it's there's something kind of.
The love of knowledge has that.
Love of knowledge, yeah. Anyway, I don't mean to divert,
mm-hmm,
from that, but it doesn't have that container that kind of invites you in.
Mm-hmm.
But it is inviting, you know. Just.
But it is, and this is something I used to say to people. I have seen no reason not to say it again. One way to summarize some of these strands, I think, is to say that TSK is very consistent or resolute in not addressing the concerns of the self. I mean, in one sense, you could say, well, yes, you know, we start, you've got to have some motivation to engage this. You've got to have some motivation to do anything. And the motivation has to do with, you know, time being too pressured and space being too crowded, and we say things like that. But once you're actually embarked on the process, it doesn't feed the self in the way that it wants to be fed.
Mm-hmm. Or that it's familiarly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
But it feeds being with joy,
yeah,
and things like that, and beauty, and yeah.
Yeah, well, that's right. But you know, the self is used to looking for certain kinds of nourishment or rewards, and it doesn't get those.
That's why I said the psychological work needs to be done on the self,
mm-hmm,
kind of before.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
TSK can really be grasped.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well,
that's why that first book, you know, Knowledge of Freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's as my comment about the title could be self issue.
Mm-hmm.
That it's, you know, it's not inviting in itself. It's a little off putting, but even though it's, which is, even you said resolute, it has a kind of cleanliness.
Right.
This is what it is. Don't call it anything else. Don't muck around. Don't,
right,
try to make it cozy.
Right. It's not cozy. That's a good word.
How to work that into marketing.
Right.
I think time, space, and knowledge is very embracing.
Well, that's, okay,
level.
So that's, yeah, that's sort of, you know, that's the side that Leslie comes to it. Let me,
yeah, well, and now that you mentioned, yeah, Leslie, maybe we,
uh-huh,
need to get Leslie involved. Somehow.
Need to get a Leslie involved.
For the more funny part.
Let's get started doing something here. I think what I'm going to do is, this will be just a very short version of, I mean, it won't even be a version. I'm just going to read you something. I'll ask you to listen to it in a kind of a meditative and open way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about space. It's from the space.
Just sit there. Well, that's a Zen thing. Don't think about it. Just sit there.
Right. That's true. That's true. So I'm just going to read you this section, which is has a very... has a quality that people will sometimes say is not present in TSK.
Which book?
It's from Sacred Dimensions. And it's the section, it's in the space section, and it's a chapter called space qualities, sacred dimensions of time and space. STTS. Okay. So, I guess listen to this in a way that you're open to experiencing what it describes. That's my guidance. The beauty of the exhibition opened by space far surpasses aesthetics, and the qualities that emerge from space are breathtaking in their nobility and value. They fill our hearts with such richness that we may easily find ourselves in a love affair with space. Beneath the surface of separate appearances, everything in the universe connects to space, heart to heart. All edges are united by deep lines of space. Imagine the still of night with everyone asleep. Suddenly, through magic, the roof of every house is lifted off. All imagined spaces merge. All the secret thoughts flow into one. Space has endless places for us to explore and enjoy. Guided by knowledge, we can make a great journey into the mysteries of space. Knowledge delights in exercising in wide open spaces, the space of the physical world, the body that embodies space, the space of experiencing life, the space of knowledge itself. Once we decide to undertake the journey, space and time support our choice. Soon knowledge uncovers wonderment. Space opens, and appreciation for life overflows old boundaries. Head and heart join together, inviting knowledge, and knowledge responds, cherishing the feeling in the heart that makes being love to dance. The journey enters unknown realms, more exciting, more spontaneous, and more nourishing than we had ever imagined. Touching the wonder of space increases the meaning and purpose of life. Love of knowledge intensifies, and being is understood. Knowledge opens and opens, allowing all being. The shape is carved in space, but the edges are not edges, and no limits can be reached. Every edge of every point opens a gateway into the treasures of space. Space moves within us, and we ourselves move within space. We are always opening to space, and space is always open for us. If we understand this much about space, time manifests differently, with a more allowing rhythm, offering knowledge new points of access. We discover a rich vitality that is like living forever. We fall in love with space. To abide in the love of space is the finest of all protections. In love with space, we are surrounded by warmth and wonder that can never be lost, only forgotten. Space is our pervasive partner, closer to our being than any form. United with space, what transitions could we fear? What ups and downs of time could disrupt our joy? What hostile territories could we encounter? Space has made treaties with them all, assuring us safe passage. In the warm openness of space, learned meanings and imposed purposes give way to spontaneous nourishment. Time's rigid rhythms melt toward fluidity and flexibility. Choices abound, and knowledge has ample time to see. Eagerly, thoughts and senses explore what space means. They discover space accommodation, ever endeavoring to open each point. Secure within the creative space of the heart, incisive knowledge develops easily and rapidly. The point of every point is seen, all part of the appreciation of space. All objects accommodated by space speak up, inviting, "We are here." All appearance teaches living knowledge. In the house of being embodied, all can become space. Once we enter and abide there, the field momentum of color, texture, and quality radiate deep vibrancy and warmth, the feel of space coming closer, inviting us, surrounding us on all sides and all directions. The field fills with light that shines within all color and form. Nature, art, and music, and all creations everywhere exhibit the beauty of space in an ecstatic play. The heart can hardly contain such boundless and intense beauty. The spirit can barely accommodate the richness of touching space directly and incisively. Yet once in the womb of space, united beyond barriers, being relaxes, free of any interference, any possibility of loss. Here is freedom. Here is home. Adjust what I'm going to adjust what we our practice. Let's go outside and do what you might think of as a space inquiry. And the basic instruction is this: as you encounter objects, living things, and space, look at the edges that define and shape, and let yourself explore the relationship between the space within and the space without, and ask what that notion of edges and boundaries and identities means in light of a kind of pervasive brotherhood of space, a kind of all-allowing availability of space that accommodates all forms, all shapes, all identities, all thoughts. And you can do that looking at objects, looking at the living world, because that really, in some ways, offers something else. Or at your own thoughts, your own mental events. In every case, just looking at the edges and the space within and without that accommodates all of that. So let's go outside for about 20 minutes and do that, okay? Mm-hmm. Chapter with page, right.
Isn't that beautiful? Oh my God.
forgotten how beautiful that was.
Mm. 61 pages, 61 to 65.
Rinpoche is a poet. He's a poet. I can't find my pen. Where do you go, Dawn? I have one over it. Yeah, I've got. I went to my car and got my pen. Like those pens. I'm gonna write poetry.
Thank you, Jack, for reading that.
Mm-hmm.
That was so beautiful.
Oh, oh dear.
I really would love to be more involved with TSK. If there's some way, if some kind of program opens up or something.
It's okay. I mean, the reason I hesitate is just because there's it's just a lot of things that I don't know, how they're going to develop.
I know.
But it's good to know that.
And you know what? I'm going to continue being involved in TSK, even no matter where I'm at.
Right. I mean, it would lead us, but I understand.
I would just love to be able to stay, you know.
Right.
Stay in Berkeley or somewhere and be involved, but
yeah.
That might be possible one day. You never know what's going to happen.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
I think poetry that I've been writing over the last year has become richer.
Hmm.
And I've noticed just since I've been here, the moments that I've been posting are richer because of the experience and practice. And I've carried the practice into my writing of the moments. So that's been really cool.
Okay. That's richer is one of the words. One of the words that connects us to TSK, isn't it?
Yeah. It does.
Richer. We can have our own. There's richer, there's intimacy, there's so many words actually, vastness.
I seem to be running out of words. Since, you know, I've been able to use intimacy and rich and so much. I was stuck on beauty and joy and history. There's only so many ways it can possibly describe it.
Right. Thank you. Okay. So we are at the place, the time where we would normally take a break, but I'd like to give you a chance to share a little about that experience. And so we'll take our break a little later, if that's okay. So we came into that practice, which I wasn't planning on doing, but it's fun. We came into that practice in a kind of a backward way. I mean, it grew out of the reading. It's not backwards, it's not how I usually do it, I guess. Anyway, I don't know if that was helpful to people or an obstacle, but I'd be happy to hear from you.
It was very helpful. It was very inspiring. You already know that. I wrote two points about space.
Boundaries, separations.
Separation, I can't hear you.
Okay, if I sit next to you, it will help.
No, that's all right. I'll make it more of that. I'm sorry.
Boundaries, separations, surfaces, densities, all easing, thinning, lightening. Access, connection, belonging, easing, settling. All an inner happening that reaches far out. Oneness. One taste. Center. Appearing.
Tina, would you like to read one of your poems?
Okay. I read Space of Maroon. I did not notice you before, so lovely in your space. It must have been just yesterday that I walked by in haste. How could I have missed your mind, so brilliant and so true? Your form so perfectly at home in your maroon. I wanted so to smell your smell and linger for a while in your space so open. You gave joy to my child. So green are your attendants. You lay gently on your white. Space of maroon, you open up my heart and it takes flight. It's that little white, that flower, that maroon flower out there, that's lines on the white and the beautiful green leaves. Mm-hmm.
Fly light on my hand, and you know what we normally do. But it was incredibly beautiful. It was lit up green and gold and bronze like the sun, and the complexity of its eye. I was just staring around. Look at you.
That's cool.
Uh, think that one of the qualities that, or one of the aspects of our experience that causes a lot of pain in the sense of loss is separation. And distance. And there's lots of words there, you know, cut off. And sitting out there just now, what was very helpful for me was the space. First of all, space unites. You know, it's from a space perspective, there's none of that. It's just, you know, those are structures that we impose. And given that, the sense of cut offness that seemed to me the most powerful to let go of was really, you know, me as the one who is experiencing this, and recognizing that, you know, even the distinction between the physical and the mental, it's one way of saying it, that I was thinking about. That's also something that doesn't matter for space. That's a distinction that we impose. And then afterwards, coming back in here, there was this kind of businessy thing going on over here. You know, some PG&E guys were out doing an energy audit, apparently. and so I came in here and sat down, and I think partly because of that, but I don't know exactly. That kind of cut off feeling came back. And then I thought, well, but even that cut off feeling, space doesn't care. That's part of it too.
Mm-hmm. That was helpful. Mm-hmm.
I had just a phrase come up, there are no edges.
Mm-hmm.
That seems similar to,
yeah.
But it's true, you just keep assuming there are. Space accommodates, it's a kind of coziness.
The coziness, right, but this is pretty much like
commodious.
There's that lovely image in there about imagine everybody asleep at night,
mm-hmm.
And magically all the roofs are lifted off.
That. I remember when I first heard that.
I remember when Rinpoche gave that image, it immediately reminded me of a painting that I suppose I should bring in now by Chagall.
Mm-hmm. So
there's lots of Chagall images where he shows fiddlers, you know, violinists playing up in the sky over above the rooftops. And it just was very much like that. I showed it to Rinpoche, but he wasn't too interested. But he wasn't too interested. Oh, okay. But for me it was meaningful and yeah, that sense that is actually one reason maybe it's such a nice image is that you you get to be cozy in your bed, but it doesn't turn into a kind of a separation, you know, all the roofs have disappeared, so both are true at once.
You know, I'm struck by what I was thinking before when it was quiet, and thinking back to you reading that and evoking for me, I think for some, like for others, a sense of space and
mm-hmm.
quiet, and then the exercise adding to that. And when we came back, it was very quiet, and nobody was leaping into saying anything. And then for me, as we started to talk, you know, that felt like it's changed it a little bit. I mean, appreciate the comments, but it seems like the, so it goes back to one of the things I was thinking about, words having edges, and the communication having edges that are, in a sense, interrupting the space. And now, as we're talking, it's some of that sense of spaciousness for me has gone away a little bit. Not, I mean, it doesn't need to be critical at all of the comments, because I appreciated that, but I'm just noticing, for me at least, the quality changing from that quiet sense of space and my own sense of that, and the, somewhat of a sense of other people. Obviously, I can think where other people are here, and we're all contributing in some way to that sense of space. But again, the talking, it's like it's cut up the space a little bit.
Edgier.
Yeah, to produce some edges that weren't there when it was just a little more quiet.
Yeah, that's true.
That's interesting.
Unless the words do that marriage of sound and breath, and then we're off again.
It makes me think also something that you said about how, you know, getting to some sense of quiet or centeredness in some of the words that you're using and what you're reading, and then how do you, you know, keep that, or how do you keep that quality when then there's interaction or other day-to-day activity, and there's a sense of losing something you might get to in a meditation or something, and something about that.
I don't think in terms of there are no edges, but just that edges and words are space too. Space in space. Space.
Well, I'm learning. Especially with the example he also said about the Virginia guys, because I saw them too coming in. And he also kind of, by sharing what he shared, a little bit taught me that, you know, that calmness that you refer to is definitely going to be interrupted by voices, by PG&E guys, by our work, by joining and so forth. But could I keep reading that page every single day when I wake up, and then at noon maybe I take a break and I usually read it again. I try, because it is an inner tweaking. If I could adjust and tweak that inner, then I can maintain it here and then allow the edges come in and go. And Jack has said that many times to me. It never resonated as much as it does right this minute. And I hope I could keep it. That edges could come in. PG&E guys could come in and out. And hold this inner projection of oneness. I pray I could hold it, and I'm going to go experiment it. It's more just settling in that it is an inner tweaking, because the outer going to be continuously surfaces, edges, bang, from sound to mass, solidity, all sorts of distraction.
So, you know, there's a reason we go on retreat. There's a reason we seek out nature. There's a reason we do specific practices. It's because we need to undo some of the doing. It seems like a little bit that some of the manufacturing and the proliferating and the, you know, the edge making and the identifying and all of that. But it is true that in the end, if we touch that, the special value is to be able to bring that back in and to recognize that it's available and ultimately that you don't even have to protect it. You know, that's, I mean, I think the kind of intermediate stage is something, the way you were describing it, Sudhabhai, it says a little more like an intermediate stage, like there's something precious and you cherish it, and you want to find a way to protect it within this kind of hostile environment. But I think then there's ultimately a stage where you say, well, the hostile environment, all the impingements and all the words and all the slicing up and all the energy audits and, you know, and emails and all of that, that's also allowed by and a manifestation of space.
And really, don't you think we would get bored with enough? I mean, I would get bored without that stuff. A lot of it. I mean, really.
It's not about enough having that. It's mm-hmm. not a, I mean, for me, I get caught up in it in a way. So by having doing the exercise, being here, something else happens, and then it's a way to have, and it's not even, I don't know if this is what you were meaning, but I know I should do this, like, okay, so I gotta keep this, you know, when I go back. Mm-hmm. But that seems like a self-defeating, because that's mm-hmm. turning it into an object that mm-hmm. you're not gonna keep. So is there a way to be in those things, which I agree, I mean, it's the wonderfulness of life and all those things, but is there a way to be in that in a different way than I would want to get caught up in? Mm-hmm. So there's something to learn from this experience. I don't think it's, you know, capturing it,
well,
wrapping it up and taking it with me, but it's not like, okay, remember all of that, it's just separating way of doing it, but how to mm-hmm. experience with all those other things that seem to create lots of edges, so how to have that sense of space. It's just what you were saying, that, oh no, space incorporates all of this, but that's the right language. So
that's good.
Which would be a different then way to be in all those things than how the hell are you saying.
I really liked this part in the reading which said something like being identifies with space and then space is home.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was doing the exercise, I was staring at a leaf and then sort of just asking this question of, is the leaf going into the space? Or is the edge of the leaf the end of the leaf and the beginning of space? Or is this leaf, the edge of the leaf, the I don't know, the other way around, the beginning of the leaf and the end of space? I mean, there was just sort of something like the emphasis being on the edges,
mm-hmm.
then asking the question about what's the reference point in a way, like,
where does it start?
Am I starting from space,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and then these other things are in space, and then if you think of it that way, they're like very little things in the vastness of space,
mm-hmm.
or am I starting from the things,
right.
and then going out? And so it was interesting.
It seems to imply though that the leaf is something different than space.
As a visual perception, it was, and I think as a mental construct in my head,
right.
it was, and I think even at the end of the exercise, I hear, and we've actually talked about it in Cormier, about sort of space going to space, and I've read that line in DSK somewhere, and it doesn't really resonate with me so much, but the idea that space accommodates, I can get my head around a bit. And and then I sort of said, and I, you know, the picture in my head is that space is the big box in the Venn diagram, and everything else is in that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have to kind of work with space and going into space. I'm not quite sure what people mean when you, like, you know, even when you even ask the question, like, is that assumes the leaf is not space?
Right. I think it helps me, this is a conceptual coming from science that I always think this way, it's testing to realize that any matter is just a pattern of energy that, I mean, it's a concentrated sort of solid, and you have a sense of what that means, if that's really so. So in that sense, I get a sense of, oh yeah, I'm just space, it's just a particular, you know, pattern of energy that's tightly tied, so that it's the molecules and all that stuff, you know. So that's my sort of, I think that's some sort of conceptual understanding, but it puts me into a little sense of wonder when I think about, like, oh, that's pretty amazing that, you know, actually, you know, whatever the scientific thing is, or, you know, how much, but that understanding of what anything solid is, I mean, for you or me, or
that's the building.
Well, I think there's, yes, no, I think there's interesting
connections
to that. Yeah. So, and then the sense of, you know, it's not like there isn't a very real sense of something there that's different for me than air, and at another level, which I, you know, again, which science gives you a model to think about, and Buddhism gives you a model to think about, there's all space, but it's, but then energy, whatever that is, coalesced to myself. So that's what I was thinking about. Oh, that's belief in space. That's a little different kind of space. I've got the spaces here.
So I wonder if you could apply that same model to words. So, you know, I wrote an article about that sentence, space is projecting space into space. It's in one of those books, either a new way of being or a new kind of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And it's not as though when I finished the article, I said, oh, well, that's taken care of.
You're right. I think you
but
have
it,
experienced it to be able to understand it.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
No.
Did you see the movie Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension?
I think so.
Yeah.
But it was a long time ago, like 20 years ago or something.
Yes, well, that's what your description reminds me of, in the whole space projecting into space.
There's a line that I think of in Joni Mitchell's song. She says, she's talking about some boyfriend of hers. She says, she's always talking about some boyfriend of hers. But anyway, she says, he sees the cars as sets of waves, as sequences of mass in space. And I always thought that was nice.
She managed to get that in a musical line.
Well, let's take our break. No, wait, before we take our break, I just want to say one thing about this issue that you were raising, Dick, because it's really important in terms of what we do when we're engaged in this process together. You know, we have this time at the end of a practice where we talk about what our experience was, or, you know, people kind of interact with each other. And it is natural, I don't know, natural, it seems to happen quite readily, that as we talk and the more we talk, the more what it is that we're talking about, maybe, if it was something that was meaningful to us, kind of slips away. And I've always thought that one of the key practices in TSK is to find a way within the group for that discussion to be an inquiry that is itself imbued with time and space and knowledge. So you're pointing to that issue, and I'm just wanting to underline that that's a very good question to raise. Okay, let's take our break. So it's 6 minutes after 11. Let's try to be back at 11:30, okay? 1 hour.
Thank you. appreciated just the space of being together, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
That's a big part for me, just because I've done a lot of this. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to go regularly to Steve Randall's groups, mm-hmm. occasionally to Ken and Tom's.
Mm-hmm.
It's been years.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really glad. Yeah.
This is great. You can sign up to the computer if there's a guest icon. You can just click guest and it's going to be either on the internet or you have like your PC or something.
It's just on the internet, it's on the okay. just right out there.
Yeah, yeah. So you can just click, you know, you can just bring up Muzzle or whatever the other one is. Okay, so you can explore. Yeah.
Okay.
And you can do that anytime.
I wanted to write something down real quick. Is it on? Maybe it's completely on. Sorry, not.
It comes up pretty fast.
Okay.
Way faster than mine. My system is like so old.
Oh, really?
And it's just slowly like,
It's doing that. I finally just like, I got a new one like 2 months ago. So it's like, I can't do that anymore.
And my laptop died a couple months ago.
Oh.
So I'm like, yeah, I'm suffering here.
Thank you.
Okay, so we were focusing in the session before the break, we ended up focusing on space. Let's go back into time a bit, and the sense is similar. You know, the kind of basic message you could say with respect to space and time is similar in the sense that you say space allows everything and time gives everything. You know, whatever happens as a presentation of time, and time doesn't care in the same way that space doesn't care. It's not, I've never felt too happy with that way of saying it because it sounds like not caring, you know. But it just, the distinctions we make, the likes and the dislikes and the closed and the open and the here and the there and the self and the world, doesn't make any sense to time or to space. So that's what I mean when I say the same, that those things are that space and time are kind of equivalent in that way, or have something similar going on. So we'll do a practice which is a kind of exploration of how we usually understand time, and that has to do with our imposition of a story. We've talked about that last night, right? We make sense out of things, and there's this forward momentum, which Rinpoche very much links up to the self's need to get certain things, you know, because the self is nothing by itself, as we've discussed. It reaches out into the world, and that reaching out is, and Rinpoche says this very explicitly, it's really interesting, he says that's the source of linear time. Specifically, he says, in a line that you can find in Love of Knowledge, he says, the force of the self's desire unfolds as the momentum of linear time. So, that shows up in the form of stories. It shows up in the form of this kind of forward momentum of time. So we're going to do a practice which very directly calls that into question. Is Lois going to be joining us?
As far as I know, I'm going to listen to her during the break.
Okay, right. Okay. I'm a little hesitant to start because I have to give you some instruction, and but I guess maybe we will do it anyway. So this is a practice that you find in level knowledge, and it's called reversing time, and that's the practice. So the idea is that we pick a moment in time, and let's pick the moment when you came back into this room just now from the break, I should say. And then try to trace back everything that happened in reverse order. And see how that works.
The break, you mean?
Starting with the break and going back, we'll do it for about 15 minutes. So just going back as far as seems natural. If you were really, really good at it, I suppose you'd cover 15 minutes during that 15 minutes. But that's probably not going to happen. We'll go back a little further than that. So as far back as you find yourself going in that 15-minute period, but going backwards through the events of the day, and if you get to the point where you're asleep in bed, then go through that and continue on the other side with yesterday evening.
You're so silly.
Okay? Let's do that practice. Okay. Take a moment to make some notes if you like. So take a minute or so to finish up. A minute going forward. So, anything you noticed? Mm-hmm. It seems interesting.
Yeah, it was definitely a very interesting activity. Mental exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And I went for a walk at the break, so I retraced the walk. Walking back was just kind of not doing it. It exactly like it was a reverse scene of the film.
Right.
So that was kind of fun. And the other interesting thing I noticed is I notice things that I didn't notice on the walk, because I've done the walk quite a number of times, and it struck me, oh, I didn't notice the flowers that time. And that was kind of interesting. That landscape's there.
Right.
So even though I was replaying what I did, I could see the things I'd forgotten to notice. And this kind of strange phenomenon. And then the other thing I thought was really difficult, I think I got back about 25 minutes, so that brought me back into the room before the break. Trying to replay the conversations backwards, hopeless. That really tough. I could sort of remember the order of the conversations, trying to go through them in a trying to see if you could make the content come out differently or the words backwards. That was very good.
I got a little close to remembering if I went forward, reverse and went forward and went from the beginning, because I've been able to remember
conversations,
but going backwards, I could get the sequence right.
Seems like a hopeless path.
I think there is a natural, and the way I think people generally do this practice, or find they have to do it by kind of going in little jumps. You know.
Yeah, that was the thing I was going to say. Well, one thing was that the so physically picturing things, I felt like I could be more detailed about, but I wasn't remembering at all any of my thoughts during that time. It was just the physical thing, and then the kinds of conversations. I would have a gist of it, sort of all through it together, and then go on to the next thing. Yeah. One interesting association I had during this, sort of along that line of how I was sort of putting things together in that way, sort of remembering, oh, that was a conversation, and that I just would mush it together. It reminded me of this experiment that I read about, and I actually saw on TV them filming it, where people, they showed it two different ways, where a stranger would come up to somebody and ask them for directions, and as the person was starting to talk, two confederates of the person who had come up to them would walk in between the two people with the, carrying a door, and they would switch the people, so the person who had asked the question asked the directions, grab the door, the other person went in. 90% of the time, the person wouldn't notice that the person had switched. So, just how we sort of, what we really notice versus what we're thinking, and then, you know, I don't know, there are a number of things you could talk about, and which isn't necessarily directly related, but there's something about how our mind works in that situation, so sort of things together, and what it pays attention to. As I said, just myself thinking about that, which I found fascinating.
Anyone else?
It was hard for me. I kept losing my place. And then I started feeling tired. I forget, I'll just go to sleep.
The way you described that, it sounds like feeling tired was sort of a direct result of the frustration of losing my place.
Yeah. I felt like that. I mean, I just kept losing my place. Then I'd start from the beginning, and then I thought, okay, well, no, just go back to where you lost your place. And then, you know, so, yeah, that was...
So how would you lose your place by you know, thinking
thought,
about something else?
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Well, that's not so different from living life forward, right?
Well, you know, when I we had done that really nice exercise with space, opening space and all that, and as we left, as I left to go into the dining room, I kind of like bulldozed through the door, and I found myself just like closing it kind of all down. But I recognized that, and you know, I slowed down a little bit, but I just realized how, in the moment it's there, and then it's so easily gone, and that autopilot just kicks in. And I wrote that down so I can practice that more, that linear timeless.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, when you say it was difficult for you, right, I think part of the exercise, there's different aspects for sure, and all these exercises, there's different things that you may discover or notice, including things I've never thought of, but part of the what comes up in that exercise is just to recognize how tied we are to forward time,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
and to, you know, how you really just can't undo it, and in a certain sense it's like you say, well, how could you have a thought backwards, you know? It's just, you know, we have made a commitment to this forward march of time, and when you play it backwards, you see that.
Yeah, feel it. It's just like pulling teeth.
But maybe, yeah, I can understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it was easy because I dealt in the context of it.
Mm-hmm.
If you deal with the experience,
mm-hmm.
like let's say, okay, well, I caught on what you said, 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked back on the experience
mm-hmm.
that I had,
mm-hmm.
which was the conversation with Sudhi.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found is that when you go back, there's a tendency over the, and mull over it, there's a tendency to make judgments.
Mm-hmm.
But if you stay in that aliveness of the
mm-hmm.
experience,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know what I'm saying?
Well, I think I do. You're saying that by you didn't jump out of time in the way you usually do.
I didn't walk backwards to the table and have a conversation with Sudhi backwards.
Right,
I really jumped into the experience, which
mm-hmm.
was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and really mulled over it, wrote a poem about it for
okay.
her.
Okay.
Privately. I will give it
okay.
to you later.
Okay.
And it was just awesome to do that instead
mm-hmm.
of trying to tediously, like you said, you know what I'm saying, do every
yeah.
detail to just kind of take context of the whole experience
mm-hmm.
and the feelings and the, you know, the warmth and the openness
mm-hmm.
and the flow of what was going on for that 15 minutes.
Definitely.
Does that make sense?
Definitely done it that way before,
okay.
yeah. It's,
mm-hmm.
yeah, and there's lots of different ways to do it.
So, yeah, so one thing you might discover in doing this, which would not be based, you know, not be so much related to the sense of how difficult it is to reverse the momentum, is that it's kind of like if you say, well, time is a river, when you go back through certain parts of it are like little eddies, and there's a, you know, there's a current, or you, there's this sort of rocky parts, you know, and you know, the flavor of it. You might come back into the flavor of the experience. I think that's closer to what you're
yeah.
describing.
Mm-hmm.
Or Rinpoche talks about touching the aliveness of a memory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We did a class on that,
mm-hmm.
or touched
mm-hmm.
on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where I was in
mm-hmm.
reversing time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's the way that you're supposed to, but it's more pleasurable than trying to walk backwards and...
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Some people do. They do the walking backwards.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And some people don't. You know, it's just sort of. But I always get, you know, completely stuck. I mean, I've tried it both ways. But like, you know, thinking backwards, I don't see how you can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And talking backwards is also, you know, to the sounds. Kind of, you know, I think we have a certain notion of what it means to reverse something that's based on the fact that we're used to film, you know,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
and so we imagine replaying it in that backwards sequence.
And that noise.
And
mm-hmm.
yeah, right.
Right.
I'm just struck by the simple fact that all your senses are pointing forward.
Mm-hmm.
It's just
mm-hmm.
where we, if desire makes us, it makes us to go forward.
Mm-hmm.
Although I make one distinction, I mean, is that you're talking almost as if we were really going back in time. We were imagining going back in time.
We were imagining.
That's
time,
what
time, in fact, maybe
mm-hmm.
goes forward.
Right.
You're right.
Oh, there's a switch here, and then you all start.
Right.
Imagining it.
We were absolutely
imagining
it. Right. Right.
But it does bring out what you're saying, that we just accept that time goes forward.
You're right.
And so then you think about, well, what if you imagine, which is different than what we are doing right now,
mm-hmm.
it brings it out
mm-hmm.
in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It makes
right, that's an interesting word, except because it strikes me that you would say time going backwards is unacceptable. You know, it cannot be accepted. Okay, well, so that's in a way kind of a setup for the next practice, which is, we don't have as much time as I'd like, but enough, you know, which we know and love.
Rewind a little bit.
Thank you, you're right. No, 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 it's imagination. Which is the going without going practice that we know. So let's go outside, and I'll let you know when it's 12:30. And then if you want to write some notes, you can. I'll stop a little bit before 12:30.
Did you tell
us? I said, yeah, the going without going.
Okay.
So when I say it's a setup, what I mean is that the whole idea in going without going is to kind of challenge this forward directionality of time, right? Because you let go of the sense that you're the one doing the movement, or that comes into question. Okay.
But you're not asking us to walk back.
No, no.
Walking backwards is fine. You ask us to think back.
I can draw the line.
Okay. And remember that if you have trouble with your balance, just relax the flow of the chest.
Is that what you do for balance? Relax what?
The throat and the chest.
And that balances you?
That helps out.